Welcome to 2023 with Agnes Kunkel. In 2020, the world was hit by COVID-19. It was like a time machine. Find out what the world might look like in spring 2023 and how we will need to adapt. 2023, your window to a world beyond COVID-19. It's Tuesday afternoon. Thomas is at his home office when his phone rings. Helga, one of the HR representatives at his firm, is telling him that due to some technical error, his month's payment is not going through and that he might need to pay his bank a visit. After hanging up, Thomas takes a moment to think. He knows receiving payment in cash when such problems happen is now out of the question. Since 2020, when COVID-19 hit, most companies stopped any sort of cash payments or handling. He himself hasn't even used an ATM machine in so long, and there are already much fewer on the street. It is unbelievable how his love for cash shifted when he and everyone else experienced the ease of electronic payments. After Thomas finishes his work, he is telling Xenia the news. Apparently, this month's payment is not going through my account or to my e-card. Do you think we have enough credit on our other cards to get us through these couple of days? Xenia, kind of surprised, responds, "Oh, that's something we should probably double-check on our online banking platform. But what is wrong with your payment transfer all of a sudden?"
"Well, I'm not sure," Thomas replies. "I guess I have to pay the bank a visit."
Xenia turns on her laptop to check the balance on their e-visa cards. Thomas reminds her to check if they need to renew any cards as well. Their youngest daughter, Christy, overhears the conversation and remembers she is still the only one in the family that does not have her own electronic Visa card.
"Mum, Dad, please issue a card for me. I need to be able to order ice cream online," Christy says, not missing the chance to nag upon this.
Xenia finds their total balance is fine and will be able to outstand the upcoming period till Thomas fixes the payment transfer issue. "Okay, Christy, I will be going with Dad and will remind him of it. We will see what the bank representatives say," answers Xenia. Christy gets excited and starts to check her favorite online ice cream stores already.
Hello, I'm Agnes Kunkel, your host in 2023. Your window to the world beyond COVID-19. We have now over 39.7 million confirmed cases worldwide and nearly 1,110,000 people have been confirmed to have died. Today we have 18th of October 2020. Our guest today is Dr. Ole Rummel. Dr. Ole Rummel is director Macroeconomic Monetary Policy Management at CSEN Center in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. He was nearly 20 years working for the Bank of England, establishing and lecturing training courses in London and around the world. He worked for the European Investment Bank and he held a management position in Société Générale, a leading French bank. After his Abitur at the Gymnasium Tegernsee in Bavaria, he took A-levels in Eton, a move not so quite common in the 80s of the last century. He earned academic degrees from Cornell University, Stanford University, University of Glasgow, and the University of Strathclyde. I have seen many impressive CVs, but this one is really wow. Dr. Ole Rummel, welcome to our show.
Hello, Agnes, and thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here with you this afternoon. I couldn't think of a better way of spending my afternoon than talking to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's just the same pleasure for me. I would like to start with a question to you personally. How did you come through the pandemic so far? And what changes this meant for your personal and professional life?
It's been a really interesting experience for me. And it's something I think about quite a lot. I mean, pretty much every day, especially now. As of Tuesday night, we are back in lockdown. So we've had several episodes of lockdown since the 18th of March. So that's more than sort of close to 7 months of lockdown. At first, very strict and very severe. And then with the less severe, and because of a second or maybe even third wave recently, we've gone back into lockdown. So I haven't left Malaysia since February. And for me to leave Malaysia, I have to ask permission from the government to leave, which is easy, but then also to come back. And this is, you know, this is a new experience for me, you know, having to ask someone else whether I can travel, whether I can leave the country, whether I can go to another place. I've also, and this is something quite personal and sort of, again, something that surprised me, I haven't seen my family since Christmas or since New Year's of this year. And this is affecting me more than I thought it would. Yes, we have video chats. Yes, we have phone calls. But not being able to see my family is, you know, that's another big change for me. And professionally, it's also, it's changed quite a bit. I do a lot of training, and this has moved online. And I know that this is the new normal, but I'm not really happy about an online world.
So you have to bear some severe restrictions, and it makes a big difference to you.
It does. I can leave my house, or I can leave my apartment once a day. If and when you go out, you can only go out in pairs, so it's a maximum of two people. Shops and restaurants are open, but they close at 6. Normally, the regular working hours in Malaysia are 10 to 10, 10 in the morning to 10 at night. But now everything closes at 6.
That's really heavy. Mm. You are director at CSAN. Could you explain to our listeners what's CSAN?
Certainly. The full name is the Southeast Asian Central Banks, which explains the CSAN Research and Training Center. So this is an institution that belongs to 19 central banks in Asia. And as you kindly said in your introduction, I'm the director for macroeconomic and monetary policy management.
So this is a joint venture of these 19 central banks, CSAN. And
correct.
The main purpose is to train central bankers, people working in central banks, and to improve the knowledge and this by trainings. That's correct?
That is correct. In my capacity, we do 8 courses, between 8 to 10 courses of 5 days on particular issues in macroeconomics and monetary policy. So this could be anything from the implementation of monetary policy. How do you do that? Or what is international best practice, and how do the members do it? So there's a lot of learning from the members from each other, because we have a very interesting membership. So included in the 19 members are some very big countries, some very important countries such as China and India, and also increasingly Indonesia with its 280 million people. But we also have some very small countries such as Myanmar and Brunei, Laos. So it's a very heterogeneous, it's a very diverse membership, ranging from, you know, Korea, that's a member of the G20, as is India, China, and Indonesia. And then we have some very small countries that are not quite as advanced as the others. So there's scope for learning for the smaller members from the bigger members or the more advanced members, because many of the issues are similar across the whole region.
Oh, I understand. As typically the activities of central banks are not so familiar even to people that are business people and are quite easy with these economics you have in daily business life. Could you tell us a little bit about the core activities of a central bank?
Certainly. Agnes, how much time do you have? I could talk about this.
We have all the time we need.
as the saying goes. So most modern central banks would define themselves by having two purposes. And these purposes are monetary stability and financial stability. Now, the first one is quite easy to explain. And for most central banks, it is price stability. So having a low and stable inflation rate. Financial stability is more difficult to explain, but it generally means a financial system that is working well, that is well regulated, that is functioning well, that is providing credit to whoever needs credit. And that also includes the payment system, i.e., you know, we all want to get paid at the end of the month. So we want the financial system to work well, and we want the payment system to work well as well.
I have listened to your podcasts, as CSAN has a very interesting podcast itself. And in one of these podcasts, someone described central bankers as the cops of the financial system. Would you agree with that description?
I would to a certain extent. The reason I would disagree is that to be the cops, you need to have the power of the police. And not every country has that particular system set up. So ideally, we now believe that the central bank should also be regulating and supervising the banks. So in that sense, I agree with you. But some countries, either the supervision or the regulation is outside the central bank. And a big prominent example would be the euro area, for example, where supervision is not within the ECB.
Mm. Yes, you are absolutely right.
So in that case, the central bank relies on the other cop, on some substitute cop to do the work for us. And I mean, we don't really know what the best system is. I used to work at the Bank of England, and we tried one system and we had a crisis. Then we tried the other system and we had a crisis. So there is no sort of, you know, the best system. But in general, we would like to be the cops to prevent banks doing silly things.
Sounds good. When we go back to March, as you said, when COVID-19 hit the world and everyone understood that's now a pandemic and not just a small thing, what had been the first reactions to COVID-19 at your organization, CSAN, and maybe in big central banks, as far as you have an overview over this?
Sadly, at least in this region, COVID is not the first episode of this type. I mean, there was SARS back in 2001, I believe. There was whatever was called H1N1 a few years later. So Asia, or more specifically China, has seen, so this is the third pandemic that I know of in this region. And I mean, I have to say, I was always a bit dismissive when traveling in this region, I mean, even before COVID. You know, people are much more comfortable wearing masks than they are in other places around the world. In that sense, the COVID did not come as much, it was still a shock, but at least there was some familiarity with the mechanisms that have to be put into place when it hit. And I was told of Singapore, for example, one of the first things that happened was you had to get your temperature taken in all sorts of places. And Singapore, I was told, there was a big warehouse in Singapore where they kept these machines to read your temperature as you walk past them. And they still had that available, you know, whatever, 10,000 of these machines still there from the SARS crisis in 2001. So they were very quick in just putting up those machines again at entrances to buildings, entrances to the underground, entrances to the airport. There was more experience with the pandemic than in other places. I still believe that the scale and the severity came as a big surprise, probably as much as in other places. Malaysia was very quick to close the borders, impose a very strict lockdown. Malaysia has 11 states, so impose a very strict, you couldn't travel between the states, and so on. In my office, we first tried, I think what a lot of offices tried, which is to have sort of a red team and a blue team, and the red team would come in 1 week and then alternate with the blue team. So we kind of split into two teams and tried that. But it became pretty obvious very quickly that the only way to beat this was to not go to the office at all. And in fact, we're not telling people to come back to the office at least until the end of the year.
That's a long time. When mm-hmm. when we think about the office and maybe the offices of central banks, had central banks been prepared to work remote?
Not really. So the most central banks I know of operate with sort of a skeleton crew. Only about 20% of people are working in the central bank at any one point. So these would be sort of mission critical people who look after, for example, the payment system, making sure that money flows to wherever it needs to flow. It's the IT people to make sure that all the systems are up and running. Pretty much everyone else is working from home, which has caused a lot of problems in the sense that I know of one or two colleagues of mine who don't have Wi-Fi at home. If they want to get some work done, they have to go to a coffee shop or they have to go to a hotel lobby, which means it's noisy. It's not private. Some of the people, for example, the HR people in my office, you know, they deal with confidential information. Yeah. Can you do this in a coffee shop with the people looking over your shoulder? Some of the central banks are dealing with very market sensitive, market moving information. Yeah. Can you send that via email from your home? Within the central bank, you have a secure system. If you send it from one part of the central bank to the other, if you send it from someone's private house to the central bank or to a colleague, is that information still secure? And there was also a lot of experimentation with what is the best system. Is it Zoom? Is it Teams? Is it Google Hangouts? Is it? So how do you set this up? And it took about, a couple of weeks to a month to get that up and running.
So that was quite a change, and it was acceleration to maybe move to a more advanced technical structure.
Absolutely. And it's also central bankers do a lot of talking with other central banks as well. So this raises the question, how do you communicate securely, safely with other central banks, not only in the region, but also globally? In addition, there are meetings every two months in Basel. There's an organization which is sort of the central bank of central banks. How do you organize that? On many occasions, you get to see people every 2 months, but you know, trying to combine central bankers from the Americas with central bankers from Asia and the time differences and all that, I think it raised some issues we never really thought about before. In that sense, it was quite interesting and challenging in trying to get this up and running. But I think we've established a pretty good equilibrium by now.
You say now the technical infrastructure is running, and it is at the moment sufficient to keep everything in the monetary system running, but it has downside in not seeing people, not being able to have informal talks, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I think the technology is working relatively well. I mean, that doesn't mean that, you know, there's not the occasional power failure, or there's not the occasional Wi-Fi playing up. In Malaysia, we have twice a year, we have a monsoon season. So there's a thunderstorm every afternoon. A thunderstorm is not good for Wi-Fi and internet and all that. But, you know, you always find a workaround for this.
When we just jump to the little narrative at the beginning of the episode, there the people or the family talked about the ceasing use of cash, that ATM machines are reduced, and that people refrained from using bank cash as they were afraid for germs and infectious particles, viruses on the cash notes. Do you have any evidence that the use of cash was reduced during pandemic times?
It was indeed. Generally, I have to say, in my experience in this region, it's very much a generational issue. So that's sort of part of it. And the younger generation, very comfortable with mobile phones, with apps, with the required technology, and also very comfortable about giving up a lot of their privacy. I think in the sort of trade-off between ease of use and privacy, a lot of the younger people, not only in Malaysia, but in many other countries, are quite happy to give up privacy in return for doing things very easily on their phones. My experience, the same is not necessarily true for the older generation. Another point worth mentioning is that in many of the countries in which we are active, or in many of our member countries, there's a sizable informal economy that is not covered by, obviously, the rules and regulations, or by taxation, or by social security. So there, I think the use of cash has not gone down. But overall, I have seen less use of cash, probably not for the reasons you mentioned. I mean, we know now that cash, the virus does not survive very long on a banknote, so it's highly unlikely that you get COVID from a banknote. The same cannot be said from an ATM machine, but there is an issue about, you know, how do you get the money to an ATM machine? And here there were some real problems. So ATM machines were not working 24 hours a day. There were only certain time slots during the day when you were sure that you could get money out of an ATM machine, and the banks, of course, were closed.
Mm-hmm.
So out of necessity, shops were closed, restaurants were closed, in the sense that you can only go and pick up food. So this led to a big boom in food delivery services. Most of these food delivery services do not accept cash. So you could only pay via the app. The same is true for people not wanting to use public transportation. So these rideshare companies, so the big one here in Malaysia or in many areas, many countries in Asia is called Grab. So they wouldn't accept cash. So you had to get the Grab wallet to pay your sort of rideshare. So I think there's been a big increase in people using less cash.
Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting. And here we see these many effects of the pandemia. You won't think in the first point. The little girl in our story, she's very fond of ice cream. And in the end of the story, she is afraid, or she thinks about if she has now to get a credit card to buy ice cream. What are the solutions when you go for these small amounts of money? You talked about the Grab wallet. What does this mean, or how does this system work?
Okay, the system basically works as follows. So most of these things start off as an app. So I have an app to call a car to, i.e. this private driver who then drives me from A to B. Now, it starts off as simply some sort of technology to connect me with the closest driver who will then pick me up and drop me off again. Now, an obvious next step is, why not also arrange the payment with that app? So there is a possibility I can link this app with my bank account. I want to move some money from my bank account onto this app.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then I can pay the driver electronically. It's just deposited from the app. But there are other systems as well. I mean, you can have a prepaid cash card, for example. You may want to, for example, the ice cream shop could have its own card. If the girl goes a lot, the ice cream shop could give the little girl something that looks like a credit card, but with the facility to put money on it. Not much. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, she only needs a certain amount. So most of these cards have a limit, so you can't put 2,000 euros mm-hmm. on it, but you may be able to put 20 euros on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the money is deposited from this card. Yeah.
So that it's like a wallet card or so, I could call that.
Exactly.
So this, as I understand, the pandemic was driving change in the way people paid, and maybe there are now different ways established where you can do it via app, you could do it via a cash card, and different substitutes for banknotes.
In fact, it's quite confusing because there are about 50 different possibilities, 50 different cards existing in Malaysia at the moment at the same time. So a lot of these are, so for example, I have one card that is good for public transportation. So I can use, I have a card, again, I put money on it, a certain amount, and then every time I take the underground, I swipe it when I enter, I swipe it when I leave, and that money gets taken away from my from the amount I have. Now, a lot of these cards have branched out, so I can also use this card, which was only for public transportation. I can use that in small shops. So many of the underground stations have small convenience stores where I can buy, I don't know, a chocolate, a sandwich, something to drink, a newspaper, and they would also accept that card. At work, we have a canteen, and the canteen would accept that card as well. So I can pay for my lunch. Were I allowed to go to work, I could pay for my lunch in the canteen as well. So I think there's been a much bigger awareness of these means of payments, but there were 50 of them, which is probably, I don't know, probably 45 too many. So there are, at the moment, there are too many of these cards. And I think competition over the next year or maybe 2 years is going to reduce that number, or will have to reduce that number, because I don't think 50 cards can coexist for a long time. So the question is, how does the central bank arrange this? You know, you don't want to stop innovation. You don't want to stop financial innovation. But at the same time, how do you ensure a competitive process that gets you to whatever is the optimal number of these e-wallets?
When typically you think of a central bank, you see it as something stable, long-term oriented, with a very deliberate behavior. And now we see this need for flexibility, changing IT systems, changing means of communication between central banks and inside of central banks. Could you imagine that COVID-19 will change or have an impact, will have an impact on the culture of the and the values of central banks? I don't mean the financial stability values. I mean more this leadership and working values.
To be honest, I don't think so. I mean, I'm not a central banker anymore. But even though I have central bank envy, sometimes I wish I were still a central banker. But I did that for 17 years. I think what central bankers value above all is stability. And you would be surprised how quickly they can respond to a crisis that threatens stability. And I think this is sort of, it's been much ridiculed, it's been much maligned, it's been much laughed about. But I think the best example of this is you know, the former ECB president Draghi's famous sentence that we'll do whatever it takes. Mm-hmm. And I think this is sort of what a lot of central banks have done recently, which is pretty much in a very radical way throw overboard many ideas that we have had for a long time that were regarded as sacred cows, sort of, you know, holy principles that could never be changed, which have disappeared overnight in response to the crisis. So when things threaten, like the way COVID has, fundamentally threaten the stability of the domestic or even the global economy, central bankers can be very quick in terms of putting through the required changes.
Thank you so far for your time, Ole. And as central banks and the financial systems are a very complex, but at the same time, very important aspect for business and private life, And as we have found with Dr. Rummel, not only an expert on all these topics, but also someone who is able to talk about these difficult issues with great clarity and wonderful examples, we decided to take the chance and to produce two more episodes with Dr. Rummel, going into more depth in two very closely related topics. In part two, I will have the chance to discuss with Dr. Rummel the possibility growing influence of big tech like Apple, Facebook, Google, Alibaba, Amazon on the financial systems and the future of currencies and maybe aspects of money laundering and these more dark sides of the financial systems. And in part three, we will go on the other end of the universe of companies, from big companies to small fintechs, and in what way these small innovation-driven startups might also change our financial systems. We will take about the importance of technology and the necessity for central banks to regulate and to supervise these new companies, which might have a tendency to fly below the radar of financial regulations. Thank you, Dr. Rummel, and we will meet for part two.
Fantastic. Thank you, Agnes. Thank you for having me. Thanks to everyone for listening, and stay tuned for the other two parts.
You've been listening to 2023. To get in touch with us with your comments or ideas, or if you'd like to be a guest on the show, just email hello@20-23.earth. You can find even more material, including transcripts of our interviews, on our website at 20-23.earth. Please keep in mind, the content of this podcast is our opinion. We work hard to get our facts right. However, if you find something that can be corrected or improved, please email us at hello@20-23.earth. If you haven't already done so, we'd be grateful if you would subscribe, rate, and review this podcast wherever you happen to listen. Thanks for listening, stay safe, and there will be springtime in 2023.